On the way here, I asked Shesha Prabhu on what subject I should speak. And he suggested, yes, especially because it's my first time here, because I had personal association with Srila Prabhupada, I could speak about my experiences with Srila Prabhupada. In fact, I would say that my determination to come here was cemented on Srila Prabhupada's disappearance day in Vrindavan. Because on his disappearance day, beginning the day before, but within 24 hours, three different devotees suggested that I must visit Alachua. And well, the first time, the second time, twice, and then the third time, this is definitely a message to me. And it happened. It happened, and so I am here. Now, I'll begin, I'm not sure where I'll begin, but we'll all find out soon enough. I was born in Chicago, Illinois. And then eventually I went to college near Boston University. And from at a certain stage I began looking for perfection. And my concept of what perfection was changed with time. At the same time, I wanted to do good for others. So in high school, I was the president of something like the Future Doctors Association, because I thought that doing good for others, you know, the best way to do good for others would be to become a doctor and help them in terms of the body. And my uncle was a doctor and a very fine man, and I really wanted to emulate him. So then I went to a university near Boston, and you know, I had friends, and one of my closer friends would sometimes just go into his room and like close the door, just go into his room and lie on his bed and close the door. You wouldn't want to see anyone, you wouldn't want to go to classes, wouldn't want to do anything. And, you know, I tried to extend myself to him as a friend, but he didn't respond. So then I thought that things are more complicated than I had considered. And I realized that the suffering a person can experience in the mind can be even greater than the suffering experienced in the body. So then I decided to become a psychology major. And fortunately, the Department of Psychology at Brandeis University then, the chairman was Abraham Maslow, and the department was, you know, under Maslow's guidance or influence, it was trying to like develop a third force in psychology, because up until then there were two main schools: the behaviorists, who studied stimulus and response, the famous experiment of Pavlov's dog. Oh, you've been spared that exposure to that famous experiment. But yeah, he experimented on a dog, but mainly they experimented on rats. And then the other school was Freud's psychoanalytic school, which studied, mental disease people. So Maslow's idea was, okay, one school studies rats, and the other school studies sick people. So we should have a school that studies healthy people. And he developed a theory. I mean, it had some good points to it. A hierarchy of needs. That people have, you know, basic needs, you know, on the most animal level for, you know, food and shelter and survival. And then when the most basic needs are met, they have needs for social acceptance and such things. But then above all of those needs, he said people have a need for self-actualization, for self-realization, to realize their full potential. And he did a study of people whom he considered self-actualized, and one common factor was that there were many, but one common factor was that they would have what he called peak experiences, which is like a sort of feeling of oneness and harmony with the world, with creation, with the universe. So I entered the department. But then, after a while, I saw that the professors themselves, the psychologists themselves, had as many problems as ordinary people. They were really no different from anyone else. They would also fight over the budget of the department and fight over appointments in the department, and Professor Maslow himself is actually a very good man, but he told a story to us in one of his classes that one day he woke up and he was like trembling and sweating, and he was like exhibiting all these different symptoms. And he didn't know what they were. So he phoned one of his colleagues and told him what he was experiencing. And his colleague told him that you are having an anxiety attack. And Professor Maslow, I mean, to his credit, he was an honest person in a way. He told us that he had written chapters in books about anxiety attacks. But when he himself was having one, he couldn't recognize it. So I realized, oh yeah, like a difference between theory and realization. So, as many of us in my generation, I began searching and reading books about Eastern philosophy and mysticism. And from the books, I got the idea that I needed a guru. If I really wanted to be successful in spiritual realization, I needed a guru. And then my quest became to find a guru. And there were many around. And the psychology department itself invited quite a few. He had, you know, like orange flowing robes and long hair and beard and, you know, sort of beatific smile and twinkle in his eyes. And so he came. I didn't follow, or I don't know if I didn't follow it or I didn't remember it, but one part that really struck me is that he was saying that by yoga you can gain control of your involuntary muscles. And you can actually command your intestines or colon, like advance, what was it? Ascending colon or intestine, advance, and then it goes up. Then transverse colon or intestine, advance, and it goes across. Then descending colon, advance, then it goes down, and then finally it comes out. So in a way I was impressed, but in a way I was thinking, where is this all leading? I was eager. So after the lecture, I approached, I guess, some of his disciples, because he was going straight to the airport to go back to New York. So I said I would like to ride in the car with the Swami. They said, well, you can't do that. But you can ride. With some of the disciples, and we'll take you to the airport. So I got in the car, and there were two others in the back seat, and they were talking about all the different types of food they missed since joining the ashram. So I thought, this doesn't seem right. But, you know, they've just been with the Swami. The Swami has just given a lecture, and they're thinking about all the types of food they were missing since they joined. I thought, anyway, they're just the students. You know, we can't really tell from the students. So let me see the Swami. So when I got to the airport, there was this Swami, again, the picture of Indian spirituality, with his flowing robes and long hair and beard. Very warmly and tightly embracing, I guess, well, a lady disciple or admirer. And I thought, this is not my perfect master. So then, I was also reading about Zen, and I'd heard that there was an enlightened Zen master in Rochester, New York, who had studied from a certified enlightened master in Japan, and he was certified to be enlightened by the certified enlightened master in Japan. And he had a pretty popular book, which I read, and so I went. And, I was greeted at the door by some of the students. Seemed sort of somber, so sort of dark, and the mood seemed a little dark. But okay. So then, yes, he was having a weekend retreat. So the session began, and we all had to sit along the perimeter of the room, facing the wall, with our legs crossed and our backs erect. And we were given a type of meditation, mental exercise. And then the master would walk around with a stick. And if he saw that any student was not being attentive, he would strike the person with the stick. So that was austere. But I was eager, and I was ready to try anything, and I was ready to make sacrifices. So then there was a lunch break, and they had these like wooden tables with benches, and so yeah, I sat at the table with the master, and anyway, so I guess one of the students was complaining to the master that the master had gotten angry with him. And then the master said, yes, actually I lost my temper, I shouldn't have. So I thought, this doesn't sound right. But then I'd read in the Zen books that enlightened souls can resemble ordinary people. So I thought maybe this is part of it. He's just like acting like an ordinary person, but maybe he's actually enlightened. So anyway, sort of endured the weekend, and I didn't think he was my perfect master, but I wasn't completely sure. Then back at Brandeis, the psychology department invited another spiritual leader from India, and he was there the whole day. It was like a morning session, then a lunch break, and then an afternoon session. And so I told one of my professors who had invited him that I wanted to meet him during the lunch break. And my professor said, why do you want to meet him? I said, well, I'm looking for a guru, and I want to see if he might be my guru. He said, oh, he doesn't accept disciples. He doesn't even accept money. If you offer him money, he doesn't accept it. And then I thought, if he has knowledge that could actually help someone, if he has skills that could actually help someone, and he's not helping them because he wants to be renounced, you know, show that he's renounced, that he's not my perfect master. So it's quite a list. I'll have to skip. have to skip over a couple. They're interesting, but we just can't discuss each and every one. So then I heard that there was a psychology professor at Antioch University in Ohio who was supposed to be enlightened. So I thought, okay, I'll go there. So I went, drove all the way from Brandeis, 1,000 miles, got there Friday afternoon, and I left right after my last class and rushed to his office with great expectations. His secretary was sitting there at her desk. And I said, I want to meet Professor so-and-so. She said, he's out playing golf. I didn't say anything, but she must have seen from my facial expression. And she said, well, that's his Zen. And I thought, he's not my perfect master. So I was becoming quite hopeless, because I was going to so many, and in each case I felt, this is not my perfect master, this is not my perfect master. And somehow I even had a mental image of what my guru looked like. And he didn't have hair. And all the other gurus had lots of hair. And so that made me think, it's hopeless. I became despondent. I thought it's... And I'd also heard that, or read, you know, that you don't actually choose your guru, but your guru's already there, and something like that. He finds you, or he's already there. So, okay. So then, one day, I had invited some friends over to my apartment. I was already vegetarian, so we were going to have, we had like, you know, pasta and soup and salad, and then we were going to go to a movie at Harvard Square. But on campus, I had noticed there were posters, a lecture, Bhagavad Gita as it is, Swami A.C. Bhaktivedanta. But I don't, you know, I'd become pretty hopeless, but somehow that poster that kept coming into my mind. So I told my friends that, you know, there's a lecture on campus tonight. I think I want to go to the lecture. We already planned to go to the movie. You know. And, you know, I was the type of person, you know, sort of a docile type of person. So I didn't want to displease anyone. So I tried to go along with the plan. But something in my heart kept saying, you have to go to the lecture. So I say, well, actually, let's go to the lecture, and then we can go to the movie. a lot of, you know, complaining. And I agreed, you know, every time I agreed to stick to the plan of going to the movie, but then something inside me just kept impelling me, and finally it became overwhelming. And one of my friends in particular, a lady friend, was extraordinary, I would say inordinately upset. Just inordinately upset. And she said, you know, why do you always have to be running after these swamis and yogis? Why can't we be like other people? And it was like really upset, really upset. So I said, okay, this will be the last one I ever go to. So we went to the campus, and it was late because of all the arguing, and it was the last kirtan. I mean, I didn't know what the schedule was, but it was the kirtan at the end, and the hall. He was also invited by the same professor in the psychology department. The hall was like bare bricks, but modern, sort of tasteful in a modern way. And the sound was just reverberating off the walls, and it was so powerful. And students from the audience, like one by one, they were just jumping up and running forward to the stage and climbing up on the stage and joining the kirtan and dancing with the devotees in the kirtan. And I also felt like doing that. So, you know, I stood up and then I looked at, you know, I thought if I did that, that would be it. That would be the end of it. They. So, but I stood up and, you know, sort of swayed. And then at the end, one of the devotees announced, because the temple didn't have a car then. The movement was, although it was like so dynamic, but it was like, it was quite poor. I mean, we didn't have much money or facility then. So they announced if anyone is going to Boston or Cambridge, you know, please see the devotees in the lobby because we need a lift. So I had my red Rambler station wagon. And so I went out. The first devotee I met, first devotee I ever spoke to personally, was Bharadraj Prabhu. And he was like so high, like, and he was just saying how when, you know, Krishna was speaking the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, he showed him his universal form, and it was more effulgent than hundreds of suns, and Arjuna's knees were shaking, and he said, please show me your four-handed form. And he was just like going on and on. I thought, wow, look at that. That's so amazing. So then, you know, I said, I'm going to Harvard Square. I can take the devotees with me. So they all piled in. I don't know how they fit. I really don't, literally. But so I was in the front seat with Janava. Who, does she still live in Alachua?
Yeah.
Yeah, with Janava and that baby who was so upset. And then, I don't know, they just all piled in, and then in the very far back, the compartment was my best friend, Gary, and Satsvarupa, and some others. So they were arguing, and, you know, Gary was saying, ultimately everything is void. And Satsvarupa was saying, there is no void in the creation of God. And I thought, and they were just going back and forth, and I thought, this is so silly. And so I thought I had the answer. So I turned around, and I quoted something I'd read in one of the books, that it is not void, and it is not not void. But to give it a name, we call it the void. And that brilliant pronouncement had absolutely no effect. Here I had just bestowed upon them this most effulgent gem of knowledge, and they totally disregarded it. But okay. So then I started to speak with Janava. And, you know, I told her that, you know, that I'm really searching. And that, you know, I'd read Autobiography of a Yogi by Yogananda. I said, oh, Yogananda. He's just a shopkeeper. Whatever you want, he has it in stock. You know, you want yoga, he has yoga. You want dhyana, he has dhyana. You want, you know, whatever you want, he keeps it in stock. Have you ever been to his ashram in California? No. There's a statue of Mahatma Gandhi, and the plaque says a worker for world peace. He wasn't a worker for world peace. He was a politician who wanted to get the British out of India. He doesn't even know who Mahatma Gandhi was. I thought, wow. She's really powerful. And so then I asked about Zen, and she said that this world is just like images on a screen, on a movie screen. It actually has no reality. But if you draw your consciousness back from those images, you see there's a light. And if you follow that light back, it comes to a point. But behind the point, there's a bulb and a machine and a person. I thought, wow. I thought that was a better explanation of Zen than any explanation I'd read in any Zen book, and it went further. I thought, wow. But then I thought, you know, she's just a young girl. She couldn't be speaking this powerfully on her own strength. She must be getting her strength from someone else, the guru. She must be getting her strength. Because it was too much. I mean, she had tremendous force of authority in what she said. It was like perfect knowledge. Everything about it was perfect. But she was just a young girl, which wasn't her fault. But it just struck me, where is this coming from? Where is she getting this? It must be coming from the guru. So we got to Harvard Square, and I let the devotees out. And then I realized, I don't have the address, I don't have the phone number, I don't know how to get in touch with them. So I stopped the car and jumped out and ran after the devotees. And the last one, means the one walking the most slowly, was named Pachit Pavan Das. He's in the San Francisco area. Not Pachit Udaran, who also sometimes takes the name Pachit Pavan. And so I caught up to him, and he was also like on such a high level. It's like every single one of them was extraordinary. He said, "You see all these people? They're like sleepwalkers. They're walking down the street, but they don't know who they are or where they're going." Oh my God, it's like everything that every single devotee said was so profound. And I was just like listening, and I was fascinated by everything he was saying. And then suddenly my focus on his words was broken by the sound of loud horns honking. I thought, oh my God, I left my car parked at the turnaround at Harvard Square, and all the traffic is backed up. So I said, quick, give me the address. I have to be able to find you. So I got it and jumped in the car, moved it, and then I went to the temple. And the temple was packed. It was a small storefront, but it was packed. And Srila Prabhupada was speaking in quite a thick accent. And I wasn't familiar with the accent, and I wasn't familiar with the philosophy. It was different from the other ones. But he did say one thing that caught my attention. He said, "Out of many thousands of men, one will seek perfection." That's me. He's talking about me. So then the talk ended, and he called for questions. And one person asked about Maya, that, if everything comes from Krishna, does Maya also come from Krishna? And Srila Prabhupada said, yes, it's like, everything comes from the sun. The cloud also comes from the sun. But the sun is always above the cloud. The cloud can cover our vision, but it never covers the sun. So then I asked my question. And I said, there's so many different methods. Now, there's so many different swamis and yogis, and each one is recommending a different method of self-realization. And each says that his is best. So how do I know which is actually best? And then Srila Prabhupada asked me a question. Like, so intelligent. He asked me a question. What is your goal? Because I was asking what's the best means. But his question was, what is your goal? Depending on the end, then you select what is the best means. And he said, do you want to become God, or do you want to serve God? He said, if you want to become God, it means that you're not God now. So how can not God become God?
He said, God is God. God is always God. He doesn't have to become God by practicing yoga or meditation. And then he said, Krishna is God. He's God when he's playing on the lap of Mother Yashoda. He's God when he's speaking the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. He's always God. He doesn't become God. And then he said that if you want to serve God, and you plant the seed of service to God and water it by chanting, then God will give all the sunlight and air and everything you need to make your service grow. But if you want to become God, you're only cheating yourself. Because why should God help the competition? He said, you can become godly, but you cannot become God. Now, at that stage, I had the feeling that Srila Prabhupada was looking straight into me. He knew everything about me. He was seeing through me, through the walls of the temple room, you know, down the road to Waltham, Massachusetts, into my apartment, into my bathroom, where on the wall I had affixed a sign that I'd handwritten in very ornate lettering with different colors. And the sign read, "You are God." Just in case I forgot. So I had a sign to remind me. So I could feel it, that Prabhupada was just like, he was there, he was looking at that sign, and he knew everything. So then at the end he said, "So you want to serve God or you want to become God?" So by then I knew that to want to become God was futile. It was. So I said, "I want to serve God," but I knew I couldn't. I knew he knew everything. I couldn't cheat him. So I said, "I want to serve God," but actually, I realized I wanted to become God. And he said, "Yes." So then, I knew. I'd found my perfect master. And then I offered obeisances. I, you know, bowed my head to the floor, and I stayed down in obeisance for quite a long time. Partly out of surrender. I mean, a lot, partly out of surrender, but partly because I felt that I had been exposed in front of everyone in the room for having this abominable desire to want to be God, which means really to take the place of God. And I thought if I got up, everyone would like be staring and glaring at me. You wanted to become God. You wanted to become God. So I kept my head down for quite a while. But then I heard sounds that indicated the atmosphere was changing, that prasad was being distributed. So I could, it was a light mood, happy mood. I said, "Oh, okay, it's safe." So I got up and I looked around, and no one was really glaring at me or frowning or
They were like smiling and happy, and I was happy too. So
then they served me the prasad. That was also, I mean, it was so colorful. I'd never seen a plate with so many different colors and textures. And I picked up something, I put it in my mouth, you know, my teeth went through it. Like, had like a hard surface on the outside, and like soft and juicy on the inside. I think it was a pakora. Like, wow, like exploded with flavors, like one after the other. It's like everything was just amazing. So I thought, whoa. So then I began to come every day. And Srila Prabhupada's program was every alternate day, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, he would speak in the temple. And Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, he would speak outside, usually at one of the universities. And then Sunday would be the Sunday love feast at the temple. And, you know, the devotees saw I was coming every day, and I had a car. They didn't. Even for Srila Prabhupada, I guess they'd have to hire a taxi. So they asked if I could drive. I said, yeah, I'd be happy to. So one night, the first night I drove him, he was giving a lecture at Harvard Divinity School. And so, you know, we drove there, you know, late afternoon, and got there. And, you know, the students were quite sharp. They thought they were very smart. And so afterwards, you know, a lot of hands shot up. And one of the students said, you know, you're talking so much about chanting, but what does the chanting actually do for people? And then he started talking about the Russian Revolution, you know, that really did something to help people, to change the lives of people. What is the chanting going to do? So he said, the people in Russia, are they happy? He said, no. Prabhupada said, then what is the use? Even if for some time it's better, it will get worse. And so he's like, okay. Then another one said something like, you know, you say we should repeat Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. But couldn't you just repeat anything and it would have the same result? Like, couldn't you just repeat 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and it would have the same result? And Prabhupada said, well, of course that is not possible. But you can try counting, and after you get tired of counting, you can try chanting. So it's like one after the other, he was just, you know, giving the perfect answer. And like every time, like the audience was getting more and more impressed. So then one of them asked, have you seen God? And Prabhupada said, if I tell you falsely that I've seen God, will you believe me? And he said, no. And he said, what is the use of asking this question? So, anyway, the meeting ended, and I was in a state of euphoria. I was just like mingling around the students, and because they were like stunned, you know, by how brilliant Srila Prabhupada was. And then suddenly one of the devotees came running up to me and sort of affectionately speaking the way Prabhupada would speak. He said, "So, where is the driver?" I said, "Oh my God, I have to drive Srila Prabhupada. I've totally forgot." So I rushed to the entrance and brought up the car. We got in the car. And, on the way I'd found my way pretty easily because it was daylight. But I wasn't exactly sure how to get back, but I had a general idea, like we have to go this way, that way. I was going, hoping that we'd find our way back. But as time went on, I got a sinking feeling that we were really lost. So I asked the other devotees, does anyone know the way back? No one knew the way back. And then Srila Prabhupada, who was sitting, next to me in the front seat, said, "Is not the driver supposed to know the way?" So I didn't know I was the driver. I just thought I was being a good guy and coming with the car. I didn't know I was the driver and I had duties and responsibilities. But oh my God, it's like I'm off to a bad start here. So anyway, gradually we eventually found our way back. And then when we got to the temple, I jumped out and ran around to open Srila Prabhupada's door. And I said, "Swamiji, I'm really sorry that I got us lost." And he smiled at me with such compassion and love and compassion. He smiled and said, "That's all right." And that really touched me. Because here was someone who was obviously on an extraordinarily high spiritual level. I mean, I never met anyone, anything like him, spiritually. And he was so brilliant. He could dispose of, these challenges from these smart students like nothing, like child's play. I knew if he wanted to, he could, tear me to pieces. He could, completely dismantle me. But he was so kind and compassionate. He just overlooked that fault. And I thought, this is really nice. That even though he's on such a high platform and has so much knowledge and intelligence, but he's very kind and compassionate. So, again, there were many programs and each one was wonderful and memorable. But I'll just skip to one, which I believe was at Boston College. And it was in a lecture hall, a large classroom or small lecture hall. And there were chairs, and it was pretty full with students and staff. And then there was an open area at the front for the devotees to dance. And then Srila Prabhupada was, had a dais. And I guess the devotees had brought it, sort of like a vyasasan for him. It was a lectern. And I would really love the questions and answers, because so often someone would ask more or less the same question as someone else, but Srila Prabhupada would give a completely different answer depending on who the audience was. And then after everything, there was the kirtan. And so the devotees were dancing in a circle at the front, and I was dancing with them. And as I was chanting and dancing,
I started to feel this love for all the people in the room, students, professors, administrators. I was just looking at them, going around in the circle, looking at them and just feeling love for them. And then that sense of love, that feeling of love, it's sort of like it expanded, went beyond the walls of the classroom into, you know, Boston, Massachusetts, the United States, Pacific Ocean, you know, space, you know, universe. I never experienced anything like that. Maybe this is a peak experience. And I was like so overcome. I never really approached Prabhupada personally, although I would ask questions at the end of the lectures. But I was so overwhelmed. I just came very close to him, and he was sitting here, and I was lower because he was on a raised platform. I just said, Prabhupada, that was wonderful. This chanting is wonderful. And he looked at me again, that love and compassion, and he started to chuckle. I mean, it was hardly audible, but like his whole chest was heaving, and he under his breath, he was chuckling. And I knew he wasn't like laughing at me. I knew it was ecstasy. I knew he was feeling ecstasy. And he just looked at me with that compassion and love and smile. Thank you very much. So I thought, you know, everything about Krishna consciousness is perfect. So then one day, everyone at the temple is getting busy. And I said, what's happening? And he said, well, we're taking Srila Prabhupada to the airport. He's going to Columbus. And see, I didn't know that Prabhupada would ever leave. I didn't know that. I said, you mean he's going? He said, yes, he has other centers. He's going to Columbus and then he's going to Los Angeles. Do you want to come with us to the airport? I said, yes. So we went to the airport, and at the airport, I saw all the devotees were crying. So I thought, you know, see, everything about Krishna consciousness is perfect, but maybe this is the one thing that's not perfect, that the spiritual master has to leave. So I asked Arundhati, who I would also sometimes ask questions to, and I asked, what's happening? Everyone's crying. And she said that Srila Prabhupada said that on the absolute platform, meeting and separation are the same. Both are occasions of transcendental ecstasy. So I thought that was a perfect answer, but I wasn't sure how practical it was. I just wasn't sure. But it was a perfect answer. And then, you know, Prabhupada boarded the aircraft and no one left. And they're just waiting. What's happening? And they said that Srila Prabhupada said that when the spiritual master leaves, the disciples should stay and watch until the airplane disappears in the sky, just like the gopis were looking at Krishna's chariot when he left Vrindavan until they could no longer see the dust from the chariot. So he said you should
keep looking at the sky until you can no longer see the exhaust from the airplane. So everyone stayed, and then we went back. So I moved into the temple, but still that doubt was there. And then one day we were doing Harinam Sankirtan outside the Copley Square subway station. And I was playing cartels, and suddenly I felt Srila Prabhupada's presence. I mean, it was so tangible. It was like his presence descended on me. And yeah, I started to cry. I just felt Srila Prabhupada's presence. And then I thought of what Arundhati had said, that on the Absolute Platform, meeting and separation are the same. Both are occasions of transcendental ecstasy. So from then on, my main purpose was to bring people to Srila Prabhupada. That was my whole focus, to bring people to Srila Prabhupada so they could get the same benefit that I got. And even after Srila Prabhupada left physically, of course that was a very difficult time in a way. It was a difficult time. But that statement and that experience of Prabhupada's presence, even in separation, convinced me that one can feel Srila Prabhupada's presence at any time. And therefore I can continue to introduce people to Srila Prabhupada, and they can get the same benefit by following his instructions, you know, by following the process he gave us. And so here we are. That was 43 years later. I still feel the same way. Not just introduce people to Srila Prabhupada. Yes, introduce them to Srila Prabhupada, but help them to come closer. I mean, in my own spiritual life, different devotees helped me in my relationship with Srila Prabhupada, helped me come closer. They still do. So many of my God brothers and God sisters and other devotees, they do help me with my service, which means they help me in my relationship with Srila Prabhupada. And so that's what I liked to do when Srila Prabhupada was present, and that's what I still like to do. I mean, like isn't the right word. Because once I came into Srila Prabhupada's room at Juhu, and I was all flushed from going to downtown Bombay and meeting people. And I said, Srila Prabhupada, I like this preaching. He said, not I like this preaching. Preaching is my life. So that wasn't the right word. Yeah, I guess that's my life, to bring people to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna. So are there any questions or comments?
Yes. Yeah, yes. Well, do people call you Kish? Huh? Okay. Is there an alternative? Kishore. Kishore, right? Kishore has asked a very nice question. But it does place us a bit ahead of ourselves in the chronology. But still, we'll because Kshesha Prabhu was talking on the way over, he was talking about they were hearing how Srila Prabhupada kept piling more and more responsibility on me, and yeah, he was just wondering about that. So I thought that tomorrow evening I could speak about that. But yes, at the end of Srila Prabhupada's time with us, just before going to Vrindavan, he had come to Juhu. Sort of in the hopes of seeing the temple open, but the temple wasn't quite ready, and in the end Srila Prabhupada decided to go to Vrindavan. But Srila Prabhupada had a very staunch householder devotee named Kishori Lal Sethi, P.L. Sethi. He was never initiated. And Mr. Sethi, from before he met Srila Prabhupada, was a follower of a guru in Vrindavan who had an organization called the Radha Madhav Prem Shuddha Sankirtan Mandavi. A beautiful name, Radha Madhava, Prem, love. Sudha, that Sudha means nectar. Then Sankirtan Mandavi, association. And they were all householders. And they would meet every week or month. I think every week. At one of the Grihastha's homes, and they would have 12 hours continuous Harinam Sankirtan, Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. And that was like from 6 in the morning till 6 in the evening. And then from 6 to 8 they would sing Braj songs. So Mr. Sethi had the idea that they could, instead of doing it at one of the householders' homes, they could do it at the temple. So we arranged it. Another thing about this question and answer is it will run past when the deity is open. So anyway, we'll keep going. It might be one of those cliffhangers where you have to tune in to the next show to find out what happens. But so they came, and Srila Prabhupada was very ill, and he couldn't really move very easily. So they were doing the kirtan, and then at a certain stage, they just really wanted some reciprocation from Srila Prabhupada, but it's like he couldn't come down and they couldn't go up. The elevator wasn't even working.
He was upstairs in the tower, but it wasn't really finished, the construction. So they, at one stage, they just came out of the little temple and were like chanting under his window, like looking up and chanting. And then Mr. Sethi, maybe Mr. Sethi and Tamal Krishna Goswami, they helped Srila Prabhupada to come to the balcony. He looked down on them and they just went wild. They were like in so much ecstasy and they were just chanting and dancing. And then Prabhupada went back inside and then they went back into the temple. And then they all said that like the climax of the whole program was at the end of the Braj songs, one lady would sing this song, Jai Radhe, Jai Radhe, Radhe, Jai Radhe, Jai Shri Radhe, Jai Krishna, Jai Krishna, Krishna, Jai Krishna, Jai Shri Krishna. So she sang that song, and Mr. Sethi was upstairs with Srila Prabhupada, and later he told us that when she was singing that song, he had tears running down his cheeks. So the next morning, Srila Prabhupada called me to his room, and he said that kirtan was wonderful. He said, you should invite them all to come and live on Hare Krishna land. And you tell them we will maintain them, we will give them a place to stay, and we will give them prasad. And all they have to do is chant Hare Krishna like they did yesterday from morning to night. So I thought, you know, they have families, they have homes, their children go to school. I didn't see how it would work. I just didn't see how it would work. So I said, I can do that, Srila Prabhupada, but you know, and explained what the difficulties I foresaw would be. He said, okay, then our devotees, from, you know, 6 in the morning till 6 in the evening, nothing but Harinam Sankirtan. So then I thought, and I knew, like, how much Prabhupada wanted the Jewel Temple, and we were busy, like, from morning to night. So I said, well, Srila Prabhupada, we can do that, but then, like, what about the Jewel Project? How will we open the temple? So then he said, all right, then just Sunday, from all day Sunday. And by that time, I was so relieved. I immediately agreed. Yes, we can do that. We can do that. And then afterwards, when I told Tamal Krishna Goswami, he said, Srila Prabhupada did transcendental bargaining with you. If he would have started with 12 hours one day a week, you know, that's too much. And he would have gone for 4 hours, because he started like 12 hours every day plus inviting 30 householder families to live on Hare Krishna. It's like, by the time he said like one day, Sunday, 12 hours, it was like such a relief. Oh, we can do that. So that became our regular program. And I was the temple president. There were problems. There were a lot of problems. And, you know, it was mystical because
every Sunday through that kirtan, it's like all the problems were solved. Either the devotees realized it wasn't a problem after all, or the circumstances changed and the problem went away, or something happened. It was mystical. So Monday, Tuesday, if they came, you know, I try to solve the problem. But Wednesday, you know, Wednesday, said, or just give me some time. But all the time I was saying, we'll just wait for the 12-hour kirtan, and it'll be solved. So most of the week was like that, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I need to think about this. Yeah, give me until Monday, and it was like a charm. Every problem was solved miraculously through that kirtan. So, that does remind me of something. There's so many stories, I mean, can't tell them all, but Prabhupada wrote one letter that if you just do Sankirtan, all of your problems will be solved materially and spiritually. And that seemed to be proven true by that experience. And miraculously, we didn't even go over time. We're just in time. So, thank you very much. We'll be having a program tomorrow evening at one of the devotees' homes. And then Sunday love feast in the temple here. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada.